Hellion Manatus. Before I introduce the speaker this evening, I just wanted to thank the committee for allowing me to chair this meeting. It is a real honor and privilege, and it is also a privilege to have gotten to meet the speaker this evening, who I've got to talk to, and he tells me that his former sponsor used to call him the Johnny Appleseed of the Midwest, and maybe he'll touch on that this evening. I don't know. I'd be excited to hear that, and I don't know. I was just thinking about him and thinking about how last night, sitting in the PowerPoint presentation, and the title was "Willing to Go to Any Lengths," and his picture popped up, and he was sitting in the room at the time, and it was just it blew me away. Because, you know, he has been willing to go to any lengths, and without anything further, I give you Jim N. from the Midwest.
My name's Jim, and I'm an addict.
Hey, Jim.
First off, I want to thank you people for having me. Your hospitality overwhelms me, and your generosity, thank you. It's a privilege to be here, because it's a privilege to serve, and it's a privilege to be anywhere clean today. What I have to say, I'll ask people, what do you want me to talk about? You know, you want me to focus on history or service or what? And they said, just tell your story, because your story is part of the history. And it's real difficult sometimes to stand here and talk for an hour and jam 40 years into 40 minutes. That gives you about 1 minute each year, and... So you really got to condense it, you know. That's if I don't take into account the using years, you know. I don't know where I'm going to go tonight. God's in charge of this thing, and he's going to put ideas in my mind. And I'm one of those speakers, I never can a pitch. I don't know what I'm going to say when I walk up here, you know. If you've heard my tapes or story before, this time I'll color it a little different. I'm Scooter Trash, you know. It's my story. It's my Crayola box. I'll color it any way I want, you know. Depends on where I'm at today, emotionally, spiritually, physically. If I'm tired, I'll be scatterbrained, you know. I'm an addict. I may be inconsistent. I'm human. Above all else, we're all human, and we all suffer from a human condition. And we all need God's help to become better people. I'll start at the beginning of my life, born in 1945. That makes me 67 years young. Can't remember that far back, but Dad said any time I was fussy, he'd add whiskey to the baby bottle to chill me out. And I was, you know, listening to watching some of the PowerPoint things, and they were talking about the Coke for the kids' gums and stuff like that, and that was Dad's attitude. Give him some whiskey, whatever. The first time I used anything other than alcohol, I guess I was 5 years old the first time I remember drinking. It was just before I started kindergarten. And one Sunday afternoon, Dad sat on the couch drinking a beer, and I went up to take a sip of it, and he said, "Go get your own." And that became an acceptable policy in the family. If I wanted a drink and it was in the house, I could have it. And I was about 9 years old. We were living in Texas. Summer, school break, I'm with Dad in the truck. I was in second grade in school. And he says, Benny's driving co-pilot. You need to stay awake and rap to me. And he hands me this little white pill. And so I ate the pill and drank the coffee and I became real loquacious that night. All night long, riding around in the truck and talking and rapping with the old man. And it was one of the few times he wasn't jerking off his belt and whipping my ass, you know? And so I knew that it was cool to do drugs with my old man. You know, we had something in common. But I felt smart. I felt, I don't know, the fear went away. That constant fear that you addicts live in. And I just fell in love with that substance. I knew I was not normal. We all know that. That's part of what drives us to using, I think. We feel different than, apart from not normal. We see, we compare our insides with somebody else's outsides, and we don't measure up. And we were looking for something. I kept seeing the commercials, you know, better living through modern chemistry, and your bowels aren't working, try X-Lax, and this will get rid of your pain, and that'll help your asthma, this helps for toothaches, and this will make you smile prettier, and this will make you a better person, and I'd see those commercials, and I bought into it. And I started chasing that magic that was going to make me so, I guess I had a doctor give me a script when I was young because I had a bedwetting problem. He gave me a script for hearts. And his philosophy was that if I didn't sleep as soundly, I'd wake up and I'd go to the bathroom. And I'd eat the bean and I'd stay awake and I'd read a book. And eventually when the chemistry started to wear off, I'd lay my head on the pillow and I'd go to sleep, and then I'd piss the bed anyway. I was a serious nail biter because I was nervous. Whenever we'd have a school play or a performance, I could not do it. You know, I'd panic, I'd choke, I'd hyperventilate, I'd run. I could not perform in front of a group. I'd hyperventilate speaking in front of a class of kids that I'd come been to school with for years, you know. And so I was always nervous and shaky and living in fear. And Dad, well, you never knew whether he was loaded or not and what he was loaded on. So you never knew whether you was going to get chewed out or just slam dunked off the wall. And you didn't know whether Dad's habit was going to interfere with the groceries on the table or not. A lot of times I got beat because it was a hole in Daddy's arm where all the money went. And when he didn't have enough supper, enough money to buy food to put on the table for supper, I was the whipping boy. And he'd whip my ass and send me to bed without any supper on some pretext, like my mother had a bad hair day and it was all my fault. I wore a lot of weird responsibilities. I'm going to fast forward a little bit. 14 years old was when my addiction was evident to me. I was going to my dad's connections and buying. I was taking his script into the pharmacy and having it filled for myself. He was working three doctors. I was working with a doctor with the bedwetting thing, and I was trying the other stuff. The hobo that jumped off the train at a place I used to hunt and introduced me to pot. The pills some of the other guys were using. Curiosity about what was in the medicine chest in other people's houses and how it made you feel. First real problems that alcohol, drugs gave me, four of us were going to go hunting one day. I was about 14 years old. Because I was messed up, the four of us drank a fifth of whiskey, and we were still going to go hunting. We went out in the backyard and pointed some targets and played around, and we were running short on ammunition, and so I was going to go to the sports shop and pick up some more ammo, and I started to unload the rifle. And my partner says, "No, that's all right. Everybody knows the stuff hanging in the breezeway's loaded." And I didn't follow that instinct to unload the rifle. And we drove 4 miles up to the sports shop, riding back. Me and this other guy are talking. We see this ambulance. And we thought somebody'd hit the bridge on the curve, because that was common. We get back to Ron's place, and this other kid that was loaded had picked up my rifle and shot Ron in the stomach with it. And Ron lived. But he spent months in the hospital. And I felt guilty and responsible, and I went to see him every day. But the doctors gave me tranquilizers, because I was having some trauma. And I learned to like those. And so that was the first problem. I got in trouble with drinking and hit and run when I was 16. I was 18 years old, and I was drunk on the job. I had a truck driving job, and it was 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'm going down the road, and I'm impatient to get off work to go get some more alcohol. And some guy's driving real slow in front of me, and I'm tailgating him, and I want to pass him, and I'm waiting to get over the top of this hill to pass him. He turned on his right blinker, and that bulb was burned out, and I saw the brake light, and I thought he was doing a left turn, and I tried to panic stop, and I hit him in the back and killed him. So I'm in trouble again. I got off pretty cheap. I paid a fine for being overloading and failing to stop in a clear and assured distance. And so, $15 fine for killing somebody, for being irresponsible. But it ate up here. It ate that I was irresponsible with Ron. It was starting to eat that people didn't like me. It was starting to eat that people were telling me what's wrong with me. But they're not telling me what I can do about it. They're just giving me some vague, live up to this expectation that we have for you. Knowing what was wrong with me didn't help me get from where I was to where I needed to be or where I wanted to be, even. I didn't know how to get from there. I didn't have anybody to lead me, nobody to show me. It wasn't that I wanted to be an addict. And yeah, I knew I was an addict. I knew I needed help. I was doing reports in school about Synanon. I was doing reports in school about how cosmetics affected people that misused them and abused them, and what cosmetics were made out of, and all kinds of stuff. I knew about chemistry, and I knew about a lot of things, but I just couldn't get it all together in my head and get my head wrapped around the right aspect of it. You know, and at that time, families didn't talk about what went on at home with anybody else. All families that were dysfunctional and seemed to have family secrets, and that's where I lived. In 1965, I thought, gee, out of high school, been going to trade school and failed at that because of using too much. Fighting with family. So I went back to Omaha, got a job at a factory, settled down. I thought, maybe if I get responsible, get married, assume that responsibility, it'll be all right. So I quit using. It's about 6 months clean. And I was fighting with my wife over some silly shit. I don't remember what it was, you know. And I called a psychiatrist. And he said, man, you just got a living problem. Go get drunk and forget about it. So I did. I took the professional advice. And a few weeks of that, now it's cleaned up again and struggled for another 6 months and went to visit one of my friends. His mother passed away and we were cleaning out the basement. And we discovered some of that wine we'd made when we were like 13, 14 years old. And we got it out and we started sipping it and threw a big party, and I got screwed up big time again that night. And my wife got pregnant and I didn't want any kids. You know, I've been trying to avoid that. But anyway, bad hangover and a resolution to stay clean again. So I did. Until July of 66. And I was in an accident and I was burned. I took all the skin off my face and arms. That's why I wear the motion radios. My eardrums are scar tissue. I'm laying in the hospital and they're feeding me morphine and Demerol, and coming in every day and wire brushing my arms and my face and wrapping me up in bandages. Rip the bandages off the next morning and scrub me up and do it again, and I needed those painkillers for that. But I found a new love. I loved that euphoria, you know. I knew that opiates were going to, that's a new kind of trip. I love it, you know. I'm there. And so, while I was in the hospital, I discovered that I didn't have any health insurance, that it had been canceled. So I've got a pregnant wife, and I'm in the hospital with the burns, and I'm off work. So when I get out of the hospital, I start get back to work. She goes in and downloads the kid, but she was an epileptic, and she was on medication. A lot of phenobarb. So my son was born addicted. And I watched him kick the habit. Because his mother wouldn't touch him because she was afraid she'd have a seizure and hurt him. So I was taking care of my son. And he ruptured his navel and he ruptured his gut. And they wouldn't do surgery until he was 6 weeks old. And more medical expenses. And I treated it like any dope fiend would. You know. I was back to work. I started working two jobs. Become a workaholic. with the access to the speed and the access to the phenobarb and some brew. My routine was go to work from 11 to 7, eat breakfast, eat bean, go to work from 8 to 5, get off at 5 o'clock, eat phenobarb, drink beer, eat supper, go to sleep, get up, 10:30, rush to work with some more beans and some coffee, and pay those bills. And I neglected my family. And I worked part-time on the weekends in a gas station pumping gas, and a different kind of escape, another part of the disease, another aspect. You know, it's not about the substance. Well, what the fuck goes on in here? Denial about what's going on in here. Confusion about how to live between the two and what to do, how to make a decision. Being afraid to trust and being afraid to even take a risk. And telling myself I know best about me and my life. And lying to myself in a lot of different ways. Anyway, the not being at home, fighting with the wife over money, fighting over the wife with the wife over time spent here, there, everywhere. We ended up separating. We're separated. I filed for divorce. Her get even was turn you over to the draft board. I got my notice. I did my 2 years. In the military, I found people that were a lot like I was. A lot of drinking, a lot of drugs. And I found some people that introduced me to some new drugs. The acid. The ludes, the mushrooms, the peyote. And I got to where I just about knew which drug to take would take me from where I was to where I wanted to be, and had readily available access to a lot of it. And I was dealing some to support the habits. I went on a run, flew $2,800, almost $3,000 in 1 weekend. It's a lot of money in 1971. And at the end of that run, I went into town for a bottle of 50-cent Ripple wine. You know, and I come back to the post, and some guy comes up and he hands me a couple of caps, and he says, "Don't do them both at once." And I said, "What are they?" And he said, "Don't do them both at once." What's he know? I ate two pills, washed it down with a jar of wine, went into a room, and they're having a baggie party, and we're just passing the baggie, you know. And I don't know what was in that baggie, whether it was disclosing tablets to show whether your teeth were clean or not, or whether it was birth control pills. I haven't got a clue what was in there. I just take a pill, wash it down, pass the bottle, pass the bag, and take a toke. Or, you know. I do know that somebody dipped the reefer in some opium, and it was some pretty good shit. I knew I couldn't get to sleep that night. But what was bothering me was, gotta change, you know? Something's gotta change. I can't keep doing this shit. And I'm thinking, if I could get in my head and figure out what makes me tick. And I got into my head. I could see this gray matter and red stuff. And I thought, wow. I don't need my eyes to know what's inside my body. My brain knows what it looks like. It can show me. I wonder if I can get out of my body. And I'm standing on the floor looking at my body on the phone. And I walked out trying to get somebody to share this with, you know. This is cool shit, man. Until I couldn't communicate with the people in the hallway, and I couldn't work the drinking from them, and I was walking through doors, and it was not a pretty trip. And the thought came to me, I'm too young to die. There's some things I want to do in life that I haven't done yet. I got to get back in my body. And I floated into my body and slammed into it. Now I don't know whether it's a premonition I'm going to die in an army bunk or what it is. But I'm getting close to getting out of the army. That was in February. And I'm getting out in March. And I wouldn't sleep in a bunk. I'd sleep under it. I'd sleep in my car and go in the morning. But I wouldn't sleep in an army bunk. I was afraid I was going to die in an army bunk. But I knew I didn't want to use. And I knew I wanted to get clean. And I went to see a chaplain. And I asked him to get me to a shrink. And he said, you don't want that on your military record. You don't want to own any drugs used to anybody here. You keep that shit quiet, man. And you just never did adjust to the military, and you're getting short, and you'll get out soon, and it'll all be behind you. But I said I was going to get out of the army, and I was going to clean up and be somebody, you know? And I kept telling myself that. But when I got out of the service, I couldn't. I was running with the same people. I still had the same connections. Somebody'd slip me a Mickey, or I'd go to jail and stay clean for a few days, and then Sam would come along and say, hey man, let's go get fucked up and be somebody different, and we'd go on a week or two run, and we'd get real sick, and he'd say, hey, let's clean up and be somebody, and so we'd maintain for a few days, you know, to get physically well. Then we go on another run, and I was sleeping in the city dump in an abandoned car under the bridges. I was blacking out for days at a time. I remember one time I was sitting in a bar and messed up, and the guy invites me to go home with him after the bar closed, and I thought, well, it's free juice, I'll go, and so I went, and he drags out a high-powered rifle and asks me if I'm willing to take somebody out. And we think about it, and I'm discussing it with him, and that's the last thing I remember. I wake up 3 states away 10 days later with a pocket full of money, and I don't know whether I did it or not. We can't carry all that shit around in our heads. Yeah. Those are the secrets that keep us sick. Stop us from recovering. That's where the insanity is. Carrying all that garbage all by ourselves, all around in our little pit, mixed up with all the other crap that people are trying to tell us we need to do different, to be better. It's a hard place to be. And I escaped that. November, well, it was actually my old military partner that had gotten out about the same time I had, Sam, he and I decided to go to a Halloween party and celebrate. Got way messed up, way messed up. And I left him at the party and went home somewhere, and it was a miserable, miserable place. And I woke up on a Monday morning, and I got this bad, bad hangover, and I'm jumbling hard. And I went to a drugstore, and I got two inhalers, and I went to a bar, and I ordered a pitcher of beer. And a pitcher of beer turned into 15 pitchers of beer. I took a six-pack of Founders, and I went home. I had a pint under the pillow, and I'm sucking on that. And three shades come out of the closet, and they're standing at the foot of my bed. And I knew if I fell asleep, them guys was going to get my ass. I wouldn't wake up. I just knew that. And I went to an all-night club, and I ordered a pint and drank that. Some people were buying me drinks. They were telling me if I didn't change my evil drunken ways, I was going to go to hell and burn. And they said, we're going to show you what hell feels like. And they'd been tucking my back pockets full of book matches. And I really didn't feel it, you know. But I felt it when they lit that pocket full of matches, you know. I ended up with a third degree burn about that big. I'd lost my shoes on the dance floor. I went and sat in a urinal and put the fire out. And I left the club. I ran somebody off the road because I was going down the interstate on the wrong side. And I went to jail. And the next morning I faced a judge where I had vomit down the front of me. And this nasty head. And she recited the fact that I had been busted 17 times in the last year. This was my sixth DWI. Two of them had been reduced to drunk on a public highway. I had 13 public drunks and some assaults. And she said maybe alcohol was a problem because my blood alcohol content when they brought me in was 4-0. And I said, probably a good job I ate them inhalers. I was a wide awake drunk. I might have died, you know. So, anyway, she gave me 90 in the county, and I was sick for the next 10 days. I'm here to tell you, way sick. I couldn't keep food down. I could handle maybe half a cup of coffee without spilling it. The first half I'd slop all over my hands, and then I could sip the rest of it. And it probably wouldn't stay down, you know. I was over there. Yeah. The gal I knew brought me a carton of squares, and somebody tried to steal a pack of my Citizen cigarettes, and I was throttling him up against the bars when four or five guys pulled me off of him. And a guy came up and asked if I wanted to get out of jail and go to some AA meeting. And I said, leave me here. I'll jam my time. And he says, I can get you out. And I said, but you don't understand. I'm not well enough to come out. And he didn't understand. He's an alcoholic. You know, and I'm in there for an alcohol offense. And he thinks, you know. But he didn't understand. I needed to heal up physically so I could go back out and do some more dope. It wasn't that I wanted to. It was that that was my pattern, and I knew myself well enough to know that I'd kill myself doing dope if I didn't heal up a little bit first. And he left me there for a couple more days, and he came out, took me down to see the judge, and I went out on paper whether I wanted to or not, you know. And I went to an AA meeting. The guys came and picked me up and drug me to the meeting, and my paper said I had to go to 4 meetings a week, and I did. But just because we're clean doesn't mean we get more or start doing the right thing. Right? I was sleeping with the wrong guy's wife, and he had a 357. We had some discussion about that. I was going to meetings because I had to, not because I wanted to. I was staying clean because I knew I was being watched. I had to see my PO every day. A part of me wanted to, but a part of me just knew I couldn't do it. I didn't have any confidence in myself. I didn't think I could. It's that one day at a time thing, 5 minutes at a time thing. Go to meetings and listen. And one night I'm at a meeting and a young guy comes in and said, you know, he said, I don't want to care whether I drink or not anymore. He said, but some pot's in town and I'm itching to smoke, you know. And he got treated like he had the plague, you know. And I knew I wasn't going to say anything about my using, not in front of these people. So I would own my alcoholism because the evidence was against me and go to my meetings because I was on paper and it was that incident with the 357. My PO finally said, I was having trouble holding a job, and he said, you know, if you can find a job, I'm going to let you go. He said, either you want the program by now or you don't. That's the way it is. And I was doing the service I was doing at that time. He asked me if I'd help him put together a radio program in Outer Salina, Kansas. And it was an AA type thing. I hosted this call-in talk show on Sunday night at 10 o'clock. And I'd get a panel of alcoholics or Al-Anons or some professionals, and we'd have the people call in, and I'd read the question and let somebody else in my panel field the answer. I didn't know anything about it. I was just a host. And I got permission from my PO to move to Hutchinson, and I moved to Hutch. And yet I'd go back on Sunday nights and do my radio program. And until I could find somebody to take it over. And I followed through with that commitment. In Hutchinson, it was a different animal. Two AA meetings a week. One on the north side, one on the south side. Hope at 8 o'clock on Monday night. Young people's meeting I could go to, the old timers on the north side of town said, you're a beginner, you can't come here. You know, you got to go to the beginner's group. And I talked to a guy there that had used some drugs and related to him and identified. And I went to the meeting one night and made the comment, yeah, I knew about some stuff that had just hit town and I was itching for it. And you're really sick. We don't want people like you in our meetings. I got the problems other than alcohol pamphlet shoved at me. I knew the traditions. You can't keep me out. We don't have to let you talk, so I'm in the corner. Can't talk, but they can't kick me out. Shut up and listen. And I heard a lot of that. Take the cotton out of your mouth and put it in your ear. Or take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth. You got two ears and one mouth. I want you to listen twice as much as you talk. I slop more on my tie than you ever drink. You ought to go practice again. You're not old enough. So I'm going to meetings anyway, and I got through that first year and I satisfied my paper technically, but for some reason I'd met a guy there that I could relate to. He got clean about 3 weeks after I did. And he was struggling the same way I was. Now I'm a vet, just out of the military, couldn't adjust to society. Some anger over to people that wanted to throw tomatoes at people with uniforms. And so he and I could relate to one another, and we worked a buddy system. We watched out for each other. We shared a house. It was actually a renovated garage, but we stayed clean. Work in this buddy system. We'd go down a pool hall, shoot pool. He had an AA sponsor that was willing to work with him. And but if he wanted to see his sponsor, we had to go down to the tavern where he's shooting dominoes, you know. And so we just kind of leaned on each other. We didn't have recovery. You know, we had white knuckle clean time, doing the same kinds of things we'd always done. Having trouble keeping a job. Sometimes we're out between jobs and we're wrecking parking meters. We're shagging models. We're robbing a Sally's box for clothes. You know, we just clean. Not recovery. Going to some AA, we were actually, you know, hanging with the scooter clubs and scoring dope for the little old ladies in AA that hadn't tried pot and wanted to try it, you know. In essence, with nothing had changed. But didn't have what we have today, you know. 4th of July, 1972. My parents came to visit me, and we camped out. I needed to talk to my PO, so we went to, I asked him to drop me off in Salina. I talked to my PO, and that weekend he asked me if I'd be willing to go to St. John's Hospital and talk to some young guys he was getting out of jail, to run through St. John's Treatment Center that they just opened up and run addicts through there and see if the alcohol program would work for the addicts. And they were going to have an NA meeting at St. John's, and would I come? Yep, I'll do that. So I went up there, my first NA meeting, St. John's Hospital, five guys in treatment, two good-looking young ladies there in treatment, a nurse that had 2 years clean by going to Al-Anon because AA didn't want her, and my parole officer. But I heard these people talking crime and time because that's all they knew, right? But I could relate. And they were talking about their drug of choice. And I could relate. And they were talking about how drugs had screwed their lives up. And I could relate. Came my turn to talk, and I started opening up. And I'm talking about the drugs and how long I've been using them. And I walked out of that meeting, and I had found a home, you know. My definition of home is a place you can go when you got no place else to go, and they got to take you in. That's home. And I found that in NA at that meeting, a place I could go when I had no place else to go, and they had to take me in. And I asked my PO, he's standing in the hallway and tears are running down his face, and he said, "Jim, I have no idea. Why didn't you tell me?" I said, you don't talk about drugs at AA meetings. I figured that out when I watched other people do it, you know. I'm not that dumb. I said, I'd like one of those white books. He said, well, I'll pay for your treatment if you want. I'll pick somebody out that isn't doing well. I'll let you go through treatment. I said, Ed, I've been reading a book. I've been going to meetings. I got a job. I'm being responsible. I'm paying my bills. I want that white book. He said, why? He said, there ain't shit in there. He said, if you're going to read the AA book, I said, I got to translate the AA book. That speaks to me in the language I think in. That talks to me the way I talk to myself in my head. I want one. And I'll come back. And my old 49 Chevy pickup gave up the ghost. So I'd hitchhiked 60 miles to Salina on Thursday night at 8 o'clock to catch the NA meeting. And then I'd cop a ride across town to go to the 9 o'clock AA people's, young people's meeting. And I'd catch a ride from there out to the truck stop, and I'd eat supper and talk to the people I knew in Salina, and then I'd stick out my thumb and hitchhike 60 miles home. Gave me 2 weeks, several meetings a week, two on Thursday and one on Monday. And Eddie there in the meantime, you know. So, but on that 4th of July weekend that I was talking about, I got back to my house and there's a note on the door. Go to Usher's, the neighbor's. And I go to Usher's. He said, police are looking for you. What do they want? I don't know. Go talk to the police department. So I went down to the police department. And the gal who was living with us had been murdered. We found a street urchin and gave her a place to stay. She was a refugee from the mental hospital, you know. And we'd given her a place to get a couch to crash on, and she'd gone out and got drunk, and a couple of guys had used her and abused her and dumped her body in the highway, caved her in the head and dumped her in the highway, in the ditch. And she'd crawled into the highway and choked to death on her own body fluids, and two trucks had run over her. Police were doing some investigation about it. And Eddie and I sent a peace wreath, because a peace symbol was big back in those days, and we sent a peace symbol and a floral group screwed up the wreath and they left the tail of an airplane off the peace symbol. And when they set it up in a funeral home, they set it up upside down, and the preacher talked about why, the letter Y, and he talked about it. And I thought a lot about it. And my question was, why isn't there something for people like us? Why doesn't somebody offer something for addicts? How come the alcoholics got what they need, but we can't get it? They won't take us in. And we're no different than them. I can translate their literature, and I can apply it to me, and I can stay clean, and I can grow a little. And I asked those guys, why isn't there something for people like us? You don't want us here. You give us the problems other than alcohol. And they said, the answer is right back here in the back part of the book. If there's not a meeting near you, start one. So Eddie and I started a meeting. And everybody got dirty but Eddie and I. Pat got dirty. He had 3 years clean and he got dirty. His old lady got dirty. There was a gal coming to our meetings, Lois. And there was some ugly shit going on in Hutchinson at that time. Somebody busted a drugstore and was selling the shit in the streets. And some of that stuff ended up in the home ec cookies in the local high school. And Wallace's daughter was in that class, and she ate some of the home ec cookies that were laced, and it killed her. And the Hutch Creco basketball team, five guys died on that. They had meningitis symptoms. They were taking what was going on the street as downer, and it was in reality an experimental blood thinner. More ugliness. And so that gal decided after that experience, her daughter dying and one girl left, and she moved, you know. So is Eddie and I. Eddie got a good job offer and took off for Nebraska, and I'm sitting here with these same people and fighting with my boss and going crazy in my head. And I got news that my grandmother was in the hospital, had a heart attack. So I just loaded my shit in the car and drove to Iowa. I found some AA meetings there. After a few weeks, I talked about drugs and got a whole stack of problems other than alcohol pamphlets. I have to show you my problems other than alcohol collections. But I wanted some help to help start an NA meeting there, if I'm going to be there, and I got a white book. And I'm calling Jimmy and saying, how do I start a meeting? And he sent me a starter packet. And he said, just find a place to have a meeting, make a pot of coffee, open the doors, and tell people where you're at. I found a young guy my age, Aaron, in Waterloo, and he had been to some meetings, young people's AA meetings in Atlanta, and he was familiar with addicts, young alcoholics at the young AA meetings talking about drugs there, and it was tolerable. So he and I started the young people's AA meeting with the condition that we could talk about drugs, you know. We had probably 10 or 15 people coming to that. But I couldn't get those same people over to the NA meeting. And I got involved with the drug council. They just started a drug council in Waterloo. City Fathers had bought an old house and renovated it a little bit and had some meeting rooms in it. And they'd hired a director and a secretary and a counselor. And two nights a week they were having a small group. And I went over there. And there were four or five guys that were there court-ordered or whatever doing the small group. And a preacher that was trying to help out because he felt that he needed to do something to help people because he cheated on his wife and that would allow him to relate to drug addicts. I went there and found a couple of guys and found a place to have a meeting, and we started having a meeting. And the secretary of that drug rehab they had ran off with the director, and they took the money because they didn't want to face the music. There was some gal had filed charges against the counselor for molestation, so that really wasn't, you know, that place didn't last long. And most of the hospitals in that area that were even considering detoxing anybody, and that's about what it amounted to, no long-term treatment, just a detox, wouldn't consider detoxing an addict. We don't want the liability in case they should die, so get that person out of here. I did find a doctor with a private clinic that would work with me, you know, if I found a live one of those that was still breathing anyway. I've worked with a lot of different people over a period of about a year. And I got discouraged. And I'd call Jim, and he'd say, don't quit. Keep the doors open at least 6 months, even if you got to sit there 6 months by yourself. Keep the doors open. And that's what I did. But when it got into 8 months and there's nobody there, I quit going and making the coffee. I can sit at home and drink coffee and read the book by myself without having to drive clear across town to a meeting place and sit there by myself. I went to college. And in my speech class, there was a young man gave a speech, and he said he was a drug addict, and he was staying clean. And there were two other guys that were staying clean with him. If we had drug problems, they'd be glad to help us. Well, they were at the table in the corner on the north side of the student union, blowing soap bubbles, and if we could come over there and blow soap bubbles with them, we might could stay clean. Serious. I mean, that way it was. I went and talked with them, and I'm not sure they were clean, you know. Guy, Eddie called me up. He was the guy I was with in Hutch, and he'd moved to Lincoln, Nebraska, and he called me up and he said, I got five people that want to start an NA meeting, and you're the only person I know of that's got any NA literature, knows anything about it. I said, well, come visit. And they drove to Waterloo, and we hung out that weekend, and giving them some information and talking. They're getting excited about starting this meeting. They're enthusiastic. And I said, and they're saying, to me, how can you stay clean in this environment? What a pit, what a hole, you know. Can't talk at all. You don't have a young people's AA meeting that's really, really open. You don't have a strong anything. Yeah, I'm getting kind of tired of it. You know? But I was in my gut longing for that connection with other addicts. I was tired of being alone. Being clean and being alone is a miserable place to be. The only contact I got is Jimmy Kennedy. I'm telling him I want to sell my shit, move to California, and he's saying, no, stay where you're at. Stay where you're at. So I went to, I just loaded up my shit and moved to Lincoln. Called Eddie and said, you got a couch? And he said, yeah. And so I moved to Lincoln. And we got some NA meetings started in Lincoln. One, Tuesday night, 8 o'clock. It was a good meeting. Real good meeting. We had another meeting started on Wednesday night a couple of years later. And we're just doing the thing, you know. One of our members borrowed the treasury and burned her house to cover it. And she was back using, she boosted an apple in a grocery store and got popped for it, and she already had a record, so she caught a little time behind that. In a joint, she got cleaned up, and she called us and said, can you bring a meeting out to us? So Eddie and Kent and I had motorcycles, and we'd jump on a motorcycle and ride 60 miles on Sunday afternoon, 2 o'clock, to the women's pen. And they let us in and have a meeting. But before we could get in or out, they had these lice combs that they ran through our hands. And they'd take our clothes off and they'd go through the seams. And they had these rubber gloves and we had to bend over. bend over in, bend over out, you know. So you kind of had to be willing to go to a pretty healthy length to carry a message. They wanted to make sure you weren't carrying anything else but the message. So that was my first H&I experience. Then a gal, I decided she wanted to help us get she and I would maybe carry a meeting into Omaha, 60 miles the other way. We set that up. And so we started going to, Shay and I started going to Omaha. We got a church that let us use the place to meet. And most of the time she and I talked to each other and drank coffee, and about out of every three meetings somebody would find us in Omaha and show up. One gal stayed clean for quite a while. She became real regular at the Omaha meeting, and she decided, I'm going to move to Lincoln. You guys got regular meetings there, you know. You have a community of addicts that are connected. Well, Eddie and Kent, myself, nights we didn't have meetings, we're out in the garage wrenching on motorcycles. And nights there aren't any meetings, people that don't know anything about motorcycles and really don't have any interest in them are coming over there to get some recovery. And then they're thinking they got to buy a motorcycle to get some recovery. We're willing to sell a motorcycle. So a lot of people got clean in their garage, because it was a place to hang other than the meetings, you know. But then I started noticing a lot of people would get clean 6 months, a year. And AA looked a lot more attractive. They had better literature, had more meetings, had more social connections for jobs. And the addicts would tell me they quit coming to our meetings because we were a bunch of sick delphines. And they were starting to become the old-timer, you know. And they didn't want that responsibility. And in AA, they didn't have to be responsible. They could just go sit in the back row. And they always handed me the excuse, AA's got more literature. And they did that. They had a nice bunch of literature. One NA meeting a week. We're finally up to the second NA meeting a week, and no literature, you know, no structure. Anyway, NA grew slow in the Midwest, but one of the gals in Lincoln went through treatment, asked if she could start a meeting in Topeka, and I said, yeah, why not? You started, I'll come see what's going on. So she started the meeting, and her and Bertley, and then I'd go down there about once a month just to see how they're doing and give them some encouragement and some morals. And if Jimmy Cannon had an addict from the Midwest that called the World Service office and looking for some help, he'd get their phone number if he could, and then he'd call me, and I'd go get them. Wherever they were. I mean, if they're in Wichita, I don't care. I'll drive to Wichita this weekend. I'll take you to a meeting. I know where the meeting is in Wichita. I'll take you. Why would I want to do that? Would have been nice if somebody had been able to do that for me. Would have been nice. And it wasn't about the willingness to get it. But with that, working with others, I don't care how long they've been clean, working with others keeps me clean. And wanting something, you know, When I was living in Hutchinson, caught a dose, you know, and had to go to the local VD clinic and tell it like it is, man. So I walked in that clinic and there was posters. You know, posters were in back in the 70s, and there was this poster hanging on the wall. And on that poster it says, if a man does not keep pace with his companions, let him watch to the drummer he hears, however measured or far away. It gave me permission to be different. And I liked it. And I adopted that as part of my personal recovery. And there was a quote on the wall that was attributed to Kennedy. But Khalil Gibran said it years before that, you know. So I know where Kennedy got it, you know. Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And I adopted that as a part of my personal life. And the other poster that was on that wall was from the Saturday Evening Post. One of those cartoon... What's that? What that artist's name? I'm having a brain fart. I know it. Anyway, he did Norman Rockwell.
Yeah.
Did all the paintings in the Saturday Evening Post. And there was a Norman Rockwell painting there, a tall, skinny dude helping some kid pick up an ice cream cone and reaching in his pocket to buy the next ice cream. And the caption was, "No man stands as tall as when he stoops to help a child." And we're all God's children. And then religious books I read, because I read a lot of those because I was looking for something spiritual. It'd say things like, as you do unto the least of, so you do unto God. Dolphins are low life, unacceptable anywhere. Nobody wants to deal with them. The way sick, twisted, you know. Can't help it, nobody knows how to help them. And it wasn't whether I could win or lose with them. It was about I had to try. You know, I had to try. Be willing to try. Willing to do something, you know. And I thought about it. What's a doctor do? He buries his mistakes, doesn't he? He buries his mistakes. And so, okay, if he can bury his mistakes, I can bury mine. Well, what the fuck have I got to lose or did anyway? And I worked with the sickest of the sick. Professional counselors would call me and say, "Jim, we got a live one, you know. She's barely alive. We don't know what the fuck to do." And we had names for those that were really sick and twisted. Millerell John. We had different handles on recovery. We didn't identify ourselves as addicts. We identified ourselves as a pothead. If you read my story and some of that historical shit, you'll find that I introduced myself as a junkie. My name's Jim, I'm a junkie. Yeah. Junk had two connotations back there. One was heroin and the other one was cheap thrills, and I qualified at Dunville, you know. So fast forward a little bit. I went to the 1978 World Convention in Dallas, and that's where I got overwhelmed. I had Greg at a marathon meeting. He took me down and introduced me to Bobby, Chuck Skinner, Paul, we got to talking about lit and the lack thereof, and when we were going to get a book. And so we, those of us that were, kind of made a personal commitment to make it happen, you know, or at least try to do something. I was desperate for it. You know, when you're out running around the cornfields and the closest meeting to you is about 250, 300 miles away, you know, the next nearest meeting anyway. There's a little pocket in Waterloo, Iowa, and there was a little pocket in Wichita, and there was a little pocket in Council Bluffs, Omaha, and there was a little pocket of people in Topeka, and a couple of guys trying to get some meetings started in Kansas City, and they didn't know what they were doing. We didn't either. Didn't have a clue. But I thought maybe with some literature it would help, you know. Maybe they'd stay, and about the time they were having something to offer the fellowship was when they'd be leaving to get more recovery for themselves, because it was more available somewhere else. And I wanted it available in this fellowship. I needed the tool. Can't build things without tools. You know, I'm a tool junkie. I collect tools, you know. I got probably $250,000 worth of different kinds of cool shit to do different kinds of things, you know. It's just that that's my, not part of my obsession. That's part of my disease, too. I obsessively collect tools and motorcycles. I'm a workaholic. I'm still working. I can be retired, you know. And I'm still working two jobs. And some of that has to do with I want to, and I like what I do. Some of that has to do with I gave more than I could afford to give out of desperation for it, you know, for myself. I hurt my son bad, you know, by not paying attention to him. I neglected the shit out of him. He ended up using. We make mistakes. Our old timers in recovery have made a lot of mistakes clean. A lot of mistakes. And we buried our mistakes. But we started asking ourselves, what could we do different? Right, Jim? Lost this one, what do we do next time? Next time we'll try something different. And literature movement helped us get connected with each other. You know, it gave us an excuse to do some travel. Find out how they're doing it. And those of us that were in the Midwest and on the East Coast, we didn't have the leadership of the people on the West Coast. You know what I'm saying? We didn't have the old-timers there for us when we came in the door. We came in kind of off by ourselves, struggling, doing the best we could. And in some ways, we were innovative. We started some new unwritten traditions in NAC, you know. Started doing things different. We gave ourselves permission to stay clean and permission to do what we needed to do to stay clean and permission to do the services and permission to develop the services that we damn well pleased, as it fit our needs. And mostly I ran around hooking up with other addicts that were getting clean and staying clean and trying to do service and gave them permission to recover the best way they knew how. And invite them to come share with us what was working right for them and how we can help them. And our area service committee meetings consisted of go to somebody's house, drag your sleeping bag, order in pizza, and sit around the house talking recovery and what seems to be working and what doesn't and why. And eat pizza and sleep on the floor. And so when these guys called me up and asked me if I'd come here, I told them, or they said, what are your requirements? I said, it'd be nice if you could help with the travel expense. Because I, you know, really already gave more than I could afford. And I left my retirement fund way short, you know. And my credit's still fucked up, people.
Because I don't know how to manage money,
you know. I still got some things planned. But I told them, if you got a place, I can crash on the floor, a sleeping bag, as long as it's not next to the cat box. We got to have some fun with our recovery. We'll ask about some pretty serious shit in this fellowship. We formed an area at a meeting in Lincoln in 1979. And Kansas and Nebraska became the region. And Kansas was one area, and Nebraska was the other. And Wichita had put in a bid for the 1980 World Convention. And they needed a lot of support. So a few people from Omaha and the Lincoln crowd and some Wichita people, we're all getting together at the Ash House in Wichita, and we're planning this convention. And we needed a treasurer. We asked this young gal if she knew how to do books. She says, yeah, but I can't do it. Why not? Well, I just got out of prison for cooking books, you know. She said, you know, I just got out of prison for embezzlement. But you know how to keep books. She said, yeah. Would you do it? Sure. She came up to us after the convention and said, I didn't think anybody would ever trust me with a set of books. You know. We gave people opportunity to do things, regardless of their past. It conflicts sometimes with what's going on today. I mean, we didn't ask you for a resume for service. The last time I did it, I was considering a service position, they asked me to fill out a resume. And I said, you know, it's easier to write down the service positions in NA that I haven't held than it is to write down the ones that I have done. I said, it'd take me longer to fill out this goddamn resume than it does to do the service you're asking of me. Do you want me to do the service or do you want me to fill out the resume? You don't get both, you know. You come to me to get the right answer about how to do this, that, or the other in your personal recovery or what I think you should be doing in an area meeting or how do I feel about this issue or that issue, and then you ask me to fill out a resume. You're nuts. Totally insane. I won't do it. I won't serve in that capacity.